Giske, and Bjarker, and Haftor Grout from Godor. He hadn't realized that Lavrans knew them. But Sir Erling explained that they had met at Ness. He had served with Lavrans and Smeed on the six-man court, which had finally settled the inheritance dispute among Jon Haukensson's descendants. Then he and Lavrans happened to speak of Erlan, and Erling, who had business in Nidaros, mentioned that he had a mind to pay a visit to Husaby if Lavrans would keep him company and sail north with him. Smeed Gudleiksson said with a laugh that he had practically invited himself along on the journey. I wanted to see our Kristin again, the loveliest rose of the North Valley. And I also thought that my kinswoman Ranfrid would thank me if I kept an eye on her husband, to see what kind of decisions he was making with such wise and mighty men. Yes, your father has had other matters on his hands this winter, Kristin, than carousing from farm to farm with us and celebrating the Christmas season until Lent begins. All these years we've been sitting at home on our estates in peace and quiet, with each man tending to his own interests. But now Lavrans wants the men of the valleys who are the king's retainers to ride together to Oslo in the harshest time of the winter. Now we're supposed to advise the noblemen of the council and look after the king's interests. Lavrans says they're handling things so badly for the poor underage boy. Sir Erling looked rather embarrassed. Erland raised his eyebrows. Have you decided to support these efforts, father-in-law? For the great meeting of the royal retainers? No, no, said Lavrans. I'm merely going to the meeting, just like the other king's men of the valley, because we have been summoned. But Smeed Gudleiksson spoke again. It was Lavrans who had persuaded him, and Herstein of Kruka, and Trond Yesling, and Guttorm Snice, as well as others who had not wanted to go. Isn't it the custom to invite guests into the house on this estate? Asked Lavrans. Now we'll see whether Kristin brews ale as good as her mother's. Erland looked thoughtful, and Kristin was greatly surprised. What's this about, father? She asked some time later, when he went with her to the little house where she had taken the child in order not to disturb the guests. Lavrans sat and bounced his grandchild on his knee. Nokve was now 10 months old, big and handsome. He had been allowed to wear a tunic and hose since Christmas. I've never heard of you lending your voice to such matters before, father, she said. You've always told me that for the country and for his subjects, it was best for the king to rule, along with those men he called to his side. Erland says that this attempt is the work of the noblemen in the south. They want to remove Lady Ingebjerg from power, along with those men whom her father appointed to advise her. They want to steal back the power they had when King Haakon and his brother were children. But that brought great harm to the kingdom. You've said so yourself in the past. Lavrans whispered that they should send the nursemaid away. When they were alone, he asked, Where did Erland get this information? Did he hear it from Munan? Kristin told him that Orm had brought a letter from Sir Munan when he returned home in the fall. She didn't say that she had read it to Erland herself. He wasn't very good at deciphering script. But in the letter, Munan had complained bitterly that now every man in Norway who bore a coat of arms thought himself better at ruling the kingdom than those men who had stood at King Haakon's side when he was alive, and they presumed to have a better understanding of the young king's welfare than the high-born woman who was his own mother. He had warned Erland that if there were signs that the Norwegian noblemen had intentions of doing as the Swedes had done in Skara last summer, of plotting against Lady Ingebjerg and her old trusted advisers, then her kinsmen would stand ready, and Erland should go to meet Munan in Hamar. Didn't he mention, asked Lavrans as he tapped his finger under Nokve's chubby chin, that I'm one of the men opposed to the unlawful call to arms that Munan has been carrying through the valley, in the name of our king?
You, said Kristin. Did you meet Munan Bardsson last fall?
Yes, I did, replied Lavrans, and there was not much agreement between us.
Did you talk about me? Asked Kristin swiftly.
No, my dear Kristin, said her father with a laugh. I can't recall that your name was mentioned by either of us this time. Do you know whether your husband intends to travel south to meet with Munan Bardson?
I think so, said Kristen.
Sira Iliv drafted a letter for Erland not long ago, and he mentioned that he might soon have to go south.
Lavron sat in silence for a moment, looking down at the child, who was fumbling with the hilt of his dagger and trying to bite the rock crystal embedded in it.
Is it true that they want to take the regency away from Lady Ingebjörg? Asked Kristen.
She's about the same age as you are, replied her father, a slight smile still on his lips.
No one wants to take from the king's mother the honor and power that are her birthright. But the archbishop and some of our blessed king's friends and kinsmen have gathered for a meeting to deliberate how Lady Ingebjörg's power and honor in the interests of the people should best be protected.
Kristen said quietly, I can see, Father, that you haven't come to Husaby this time just to see Nokfa and me.
No, that was not the only reason, said Labrans. Then he laughed, and I can tell, daughter, that you're not at all pleased.
He put his hand up to stroke her face, just as he used to do when she was a little girl, any time he had scolded her or teased her.
In the meantime, Sir Erling and Erland were sitting in the armory. That was what the large storehouse was called, which stood on the northeast side of the courtyard, right next to the manor gate. It was as tall as a tower, with three stories. On the top floor there was a room with loopholes in the walls for shooting arrows, and that was where all the weapons were stored, which were not in daily use on the farm. King Skúla had built this structure. Sir Erling and Erland were wearing fur capes because it was bitterly cold in the room. The guest walked around looking at the many splendid weapons and suits of armor which Erland had inherited from his grandfather, Gauta Erlandsson. Erling Vidkunsson was a rather short man, slight in build and yet quite plump, but he carried himself well and with ease. Handsome he was not, although he had well-formed features. But his hair had a reddish tinge, and his eyelashes and brows were white. Even his eyes were a very pale blue. That people nevertheless found Sir Erling to be good-looking was perhaps due to the fact that everyone knew he was the wealthiest knight in Norway. But he also had a distinctly winning and modest demeanor. He was exceptionally intelligent, well-educated and learned, but because he never tried to boast of his wisdom and always seemed to be willing to listen to others, he had become known as one of the wisest men in the country. He was the same age as Erland Nikolausen, and they were kinsmen, although distant ones, by way of the Stovrheim lineage. They had known each other all their lives, but there had never been a close friendship between the two men. Erland sat down on a chest and talked about the ship which he had built in the summer. It was a 32-oar ship, and he deemed it to be a particularly swift sailing ship and easy to steer. He had hired two shipbuilders from the north, and he had personally overseen the work along with them.
Ships are among the few things I know something about, Erling, he said. You just wait. It will be a beautiful sight to see Margrigan cutting through the waves.
Margrigan? What a fearfully heathen name you've given your ship, kinsman, said Erling with a little laugh. Is it your intention to travel south in it?
Are you as pious as my wife? She calls it a heathen name, too. She doesn't like the ship much either, but she's such an inland person, she can't stand the sea.
Yes, she looks pious and delicate and lovely, your wife, said Sir Erling courteously. As one might expect from someone of her lineage.
Yes, said Erland, and laughed. Not a day passes without her going to mass. And Sira Iliv, our priest, whom you met, reads to us from the holy books. Reading aloud, that's what he likes best, after ale and sumptuous food. And the poor people come to Kristen for help and advice. I think they would gladly kiss the hem of her skirts. I can scarcely recognize my own servants anymore. She's almost like one of the women described in the holy sagas that King Hakon forced us to sit and listen to as the priest read them aloud. Do you remember? Back when we were pages? Things have changed a great deal here at Husaby since you visited us last, Erling. After a moment, he added, It was odd, by the way, that you were willing to come here that time. You mentioned the days when we were pages together, said Erling Vidkinson with a smile that became him. We were friends back then, weren't we? We all expected that you would achieve great things here in Norway, Erland. But Erland merely laughed. Yes, I expected as much myself. Couldn't you sail south with me, Erland? Asked Sir Erling. I was thinking of traveling overland, replied the other man. That will be troublesome for you, setting out over the mountains now, in the winter time, said Sir Erling. It would be pleasant if you would accompany Hofdor and myself. I have promised to travel with others, replied Erland. Ah, yes, you will join your father-in-law. Yes, that seems only fitting. Well, no. I don't know these men from the valley who are riding with him.
Erland sat in silence for a moment.
No, I have promised to look in on Munan at Stange, he said quickly. You don't need to waste your time looking for Munan there, replied Erling. He's gone to his estates at Hising, and it might be some time before he comes north again. Has it been a long time since you heard from him? It was around Michaelmas. He wrote to me from Ringabu. Well, you know what happened in the valley here last autumn, said Erling. You don't? Surely you must know that he rode around to the district sheriffs of Lake Mirsa and all along the valley carrying letters stating that the farmers should pay for provisions and horses for a full campaign, with 6 farmers for each horse, and that the gentry should send horses but would be allowed to stay at home. Haven't you heard about this? And that the men of the northern valleys refused to pay this war tax when Munan accompanied Eirik Topp to the Ting in Volga. And Lavrans Bjørgulfsson was the one who led the opposition. He demanded that Eirik pursue a lawful course, if anything remained of the lawful taxes. But he called it an injustice against the peasantry to demand war taxes from the farmers to help a Dane in a feud with the Danish king. And yet, if our king required the service of his retainers, then he would find them quick enough to respond with good weapons and horses and armed men. But he would not send from Jørundgard even a goat with a hemp halter, unless the king commanded him to ride it himself to the mustering of the army. You truly didn't know about this? Smead Gudliksen says that Lavrans had promised his tenants that he would pay the campaign levies for them, if need be.
Erland sat there stunned. Lavrans did that?
Never have I heard of my wife's father involving himself in matters other than those concerning his own properties or those of his friends. No doubt he seldom does, said Sir Erling. But this much was clear to me when I was at Ness. When Lavrans Bjørgulfsson decides to speak about a matter, he receives everyone's full support. For he never speaks without understanding the issue so well that his opinion would be difficult to refute. Now, regarding these events, he has no doubt exchanged letters with his kinsmen in Sweden. Fru Romborg, his father's mother, and Sir Engisel's grandfather were the children of 2 brothers, so Lavrans has strong family ties over there. No matter how quiet his manner, your father-in-law commands power of some consequence in those parishes where people know him, although he doesn't often make use of it.
Well, now I can understand why you have taken up with him, Erling, said Erland, laughing. I was rather surprised that you had become such good friends.
Why should that surprise you? Replied Erling soberly. It would be an odd man who would not want to call Lavrans of Jørundgard his friend. You would be better served, kinsman, to listen to him than to Munan. Munan has been like an older brother to me, ever since the day when I left home for the first time, said Erlan, a little heatedly. He has never failed me whenever I was in trouble. So if he's in trouble now,
Munan will manage well enough, said Erling Vidkinson, his voice still calm.
The letters he carried were written and sealed with the Royal Seal of Norway. Unlawful, but that's not his problem. Oh yes, there's more. That to which he testified and attached his seal when he was a witness to the maiden Euphemia's betrothal. But this cannot be easily revealed without mentioning someone whom we cannot. If truth be told, Erlan, I think Munan will save himself without your support. But you may harm yourself if you... It's Lady Ingebjörg that all of you want to depose, I see, said Erlan. But I've promised our kinswoman to serve her both here and abroad.
I have too, replied Erling. And I intend to keep that promise, as does every Norwegian man who has served and loved our lord and kinsman, King Haakon. And she is now best served by being separated from those advisers who counsel so young a woman to the detriment of her son and herself.
Do you think you're capable of that? Asked Erlan, his voice subdued.
Yes, said Erling Vidkinson firmly. I think we are. And everyone else thinks so too, if they refuse to listen to malicious and slanderous talk. He shrugged his shoulders. And those of us who are kinsmen of Lady Ingebjörg should be the last to do that.
A servant woman raised the hatch in the floor and said that if it suited them, the mistress would now have the food carried into the hall. While everyone was sitting at the table, the conversation, such as it was, constantly touched on the great news that was circulating. Kristen noticed that both her father and Sir Erling refused to join in. They brought up news of bride purchases and deaths, inheritance disputes, and property trades among family and acquaintances. She grew uneasy but didn't know why. They had business with Erlan, this much she understood. And yet she didn't want to admit this to herself. She now knew her husband so well that she realized Erlan, with all his stubborn-mindedness, was easily influenced by anyone who had a firm hand and a soft glove, as the saying goes. After the meal, the gentlemen moved over to the hearth, where they sat and drank. Kristen settled herself on a bench, put her needlework frame in her lap, and began twining the threads. A moment later, Haftor Grout came over, placed a cushion on the floor, and sat down at Kristen's feet. He had found Erlan's psaltery. He set it on his knee and sat there strumming it as he chatted. Haftor was quite a young man with curly blonde hair and the fairest features, but his face was covered with freckles. Kristen quickly noticed that he was exceedingly talkative. He had recently made a rich marriage, but he was bored back home on his estates. That was why he wanted to travel to the gathering of the king's retainers.
But it's understandable that Erlan Nikolausen would want to stay home, he said, laying his head in her lap.
Kristen moved away a bit, laughed, and said with an innocent expression that she knew only that her husband was intending to travel south, for whatever reason that might be. There's so much unrest in the country right now. It's difficult for a simple woman to understand such things.
And yet, it's the simplicity of a woman that's the main cause of it all, replied Haftor, laughing and moving closer. At least that's what Erling and Lavrans Björgolfsson say. I'd like to know what they mean by that.
What do you think, Mistress Kristen?
Lady Ingebjörg is a good and simple woman. Perhaps right now she is sitting as you are, twining silk threads with her snow-white fingers and thinking, it would be hard-hearted to refuse the loyal chieftain of her deceased husband some small assistance to improve his lot.
Erlan came and sat down next to his wife so that Haftor had to move over a bit.
The women chatter about such nonsense in the hostels when their husbands are foolish enough to take them along to the meeting.
Where I come from, it's said that there's no smoke unless there's fire, said Haftor.
Yes, we have that saying too, said Lavrans.
He and Erling had come over to join them.
And yet I was duped, Haftor, this past winter, when I tried to light my torch with fresh horse droppings.
He perched on the edge of the table. Sir Erling at once brought his goblet and offered it to Lavrans with a word of greeting. Then the knight sat down on a bench nearby.
It's not likely, Haftor, said Erlan, that up north in Hålogaland, you would know what Lady Ingebjörg and her advisers know about the undertakings and enterprises of the Danes. I suspect you might have been short-sighted when you opposed the king's demand for help, Sir Knute. Yes, we might as well mention his name since he's the one that we're all thinking about. He seems to me a man who wouldn't be caught unawares. You sit too far away from the cookpots to be able to smell what's simmering inside them. And better to prepare now than regret later, I say.
Yes, said Sir Erling. You might almost say that they're cooking for us on the neighboring farm. We Norwegians will soon be nothing more than their wards. They send over the porridge they've made in Sweden and say, eat this if you want food. I think our lord, King Håkon, made a mistake when he moved the cookhouse to the outskirts of the farm and made Oslo the foremost royal seat in the land. Before then, it was in the middle of the courtyard, if we stay with this image, Bjørgvin or Nidaros. But now the archbishop and chapter rule here alone. What do you think, Erland? You, who are from Trøndelag, and have all your property and all your power in this region.
Well, God's blood, Erling, if that's what you want, to carry home the cookpot and hang it over the proper hearth, then...
Yes, said Haftor.
For far too long, we up here in the north have had to settle for smelling the soup cooking while we spoon up cold cabbage.
Lavrans joined in.
As things stand, Erland, I would not have presumed to be spokesman for the people of the district back home unless I had letters in my possession from my kinsman, Sir Angissel. Then I knew that none of the lawful rulers plans to break the peace or the alliance between the countries, neither in the realm of the Danish king nor in that of our own king.
If you know who now rules in Denmark, father-in-law, then you know more than most men, said Erland.
One thing I do know. There is one man that nobody wants to see rule, not here, nor in Sweden, nor in Denmark. That was the purpose of the Swedes' actions in Skara last summer, and that is the purpose of the meeting we will now hold in Oslo, to make clear to everyone who has not yet realized it, that on this matter, all sober-minded men are agreed.
By this time, they had all drunk so much that they had grown boisterous, except for old Smead Gudlikson. He was slumped in his chair next to the hearth. Erland shouted,
Yes, you're all so sober-minded that the devil himself can't trick you. It makes sense that you'd be afraid of Knute Porsche. You don't understand, all you good gentlemen, that he's not the kind who can be satisfied with sitting quietly, watching the days drift past, and the grass grow as God wills. I'd like to meet that knight again. I knew him when I was in Holland. And I'd have no objections to being in Knute Porsche's place.
That's not something I would dare say if my wife could hear me, said Haftor Grout. But Erling Vidkunsen had also drunk a good deal. He was still trying to maintain his chivalrous manner, but he finally gave up.
You, he said, laughing uproariously. You, kinsman? No, Erland.
He slapped the other man on the shoulder and laughed and laughed.
No, Erland, said Lavrans bluntly. More is needed for that than a man who is capable of seducing women. If there was no more to Knute Porsche than his ability to play the fox in the goose pen, then all of us Norwegian noblemen would be much too lazy to make the effort to leave our manors to chase him off, even if the goose was our own king's mother. But no matter who Sir Knute may lure into committing foolish acts in his behalf, he never commits follies without having some reason for doing so. He has his purpose, and you can be certain that he won't take his eyes off it.
There was a pause in the conversation. Then Erland spoke, and his eyes glittered.
Then I would wish that Sir Knute were a Norwegian man.
The others were silent. Sir Erling drank from his goblet and said,
God forbid. If we had such a man among us here in Norway, then I fear there would be a sudden end to peace in the land. Peace in the land, said Erland scornfully.
Yes, peace in the land, replied Erling Vidkunsen. You must remember, Erland, that we knights are not the only ones who live in this country. To you it might seem amusing if an adventurous and ambitious man like Knute Porsche should rise up here. In the past,
Things were such in the world that if a man stirred up a group of rebels, it was always easy for him to win a following among the noblemen. Either they won and acquired titles and land, or their kinsmen won, and they were granted a reprieve for both their lives and their estates. Yes, those who lost their lives have been entered in the records, but the majority survived, no matter whether things went one way or the other. That's how it was for our fathers. But the farmers and the townspeople, Erlan, the workers who often had to make payments to two masters many times in a single year, but who still had to rejoice each time a band of rebels raced through their villages without burning their farms or slaughtering their cattle, the peasants, who had to endure such intolerable burdens and attacks, I think they must thank God and St. Olav for old King Håkon and King Magnus and his sons, who fortified the laws and secured the peace. Yes, I can believe you would think that way. Erlan threw back his head. Lavrán sat and stared at the young man. Erlan was now fully alert. A flush had spread over his dark, fierce face. The sinews of his throat were arched taut in his slender, tan neck. Then Lavrán glanced at his daughter. Kristin had let her needlework sink to her lap, and she was intently following the men's conversation. Are you so sure that the farmers and common men think this way, and are rejoicing over the new sovereign? Said Erlan. It's true that they often had difficult times, back when kings and their rivals waged war throughout the land. I know they still remember the time when they had to flee to the mountains with their livestock and wives and children while their farms stood in flames down below in the valley. I've heard them talking about it. But I know they remember something else, that their own fathers were part of the hordes. We weren't alone in the battle for power, Erling. The sons of farmers were part of it too, and sometimes they even won our ancestral estates. When law rules the land, a bastard son from Shidun, who doesn't know his own father's name, cannot win a baron's widow and her estate, such as Rhaidar Dara did. His descendant was good enough to be betrothed to your daughter, Lavrans, and now he's married to your wife's niece, Erling. Now law and order rule. And I don't understand how it happens, but I do know that farmers' lands have fallen into our hands, and lawfully so. The more entrenched the law, the more quickly they lose their power and authority to take part in their own affairs or those of the realm. And that, Erling, is something that the farmers know too. Oh no, don't be too certain, any of you, that the peasants aren't longing for the past when they might lose their farms by fire and force. But they could also win with weapons more than they can win with law. Lavrans nodded. There may be some truth in what Erlan says, he murmured. But Erling Vidkunsson stood up. I believe you're right. The peasants remember better the few men who rose up from meager circumstances to become lords in the time of the sword than the unspeakable numbers who perished in filthy poverty and wretchedness. And yet none was a sterner master to the commoners than they were. I think it was of them that the saying was first spoken. Kinsmen behave worst toward their own. A man must be born to be a master, or he will turn out to be a harsh one. But if he has spent his childhood among servant men and women, then he will have an easier time understanding that without the commoners, we are in many ways helpless children all our days. And that for God's sake as well as our own, we ought to serve them in turn with our knowledge and protect them with our chivalry. Never has it been possible to sustain a kingdom without noblemen who had the ability and the will to secure with their power the rights of those poorer than themselves. You could compete in sermonizing with my brother, Erling, said Erlan with a laugh. But I think the people of Outer Trøndelag liked the gentry better back when we led their sons on military incursions. Let our blood run and mingle with theirs across the planks, and split apart rings and divided up the booty with our serving men. Yes, as you can hear, Kristin, sometimes I sleep with one ear open when Cirra Eilif reads aloud from the great books. Property that is unlawfully won shall not be handed down to the third heir, said Lavrans Björgolfsson, Haven't you ever heard that before, Erland?
Of course I've heard that, Erland laughed loudly.
But I've never seen it happen.
Erling Vidkunsson said, Things are such, Erland, that few are born to rule, but everyone is born to serve. The proper way to rule is to be your servant's servant.
Erland clasped his hands behind his neck and stretched, smiling.
I've never thought about that. And I don't think my leaseholders have any favors to thank me for. And yet, strange as it may seem, I think they're fond of me.
He rubbed his cheek against Kristen's black kitten, which had jumped up onto his shoulder and was now walking around his neck, purring and with its back arched.
But my wife here, she is the most eager to serve of all women. Although you wouldn't have reason to believe me, since the pitchers and mugs are now empty, my Kristen.
Orm, who had been sitting quietly and listening to the men's conversation, stood up at once and left the room.
Your wife grew so bored that she fell asleep, said Hoftor, smiling. And the blame is yours. You could have let me talk to her in peace, a man who knows how to speak to women.
All this talk has no doubt gone on much too long for you, mistress, began Sir Erling contritely,
but Kristen answered with a smile. It's true, sir, that I haven't understood everything that's been said here this evening, but I will remember it well, and I will have plenty of time to think about it later.
Orm came back with several maids who brought in more ale. The boy walked around, pouring for the men.
Lavrans looked sorrowfully at the handsome child. He had tried to start up a conversation with Orm Erlandsson, but he was a taciturn boy, although he had a striking and noble bearing. One of the maids whispered to Kristen that Nokva was awake over in the little house and crying terribly. Kristen then bid the men good night and followed the maids out when they left. The men started drinking again. Sir Erling and Lavrans exchanged occasional glances, and then the former said,
There is something, Erland, that I meant to discuss with you. A campaign force will certainly be summoned from the countryside here around the fjord and from Myrda. People to the north are afraid that the Russians will return this summer, stronger than before, and they won't be able to handle their defense alone. This is the first benefit for which we can thank the Royal Union with Sweden. But it wouldn't be right for the people of Hålogaland to profit from it alone. Now, things are such that Arne Givaldsson is too old and sickly. So there has been talk of making you chieftain of the farmers' ships from this side of the fjord. What would you think of that?
Erland pounded one fist into the palm of his other hand. His whole face glowed.
What I would think of it!
It's unlikely that a large contingent could be mustered, said Erling admonishingly. But perhaps you should find out what the sheriffs think. You're well known in this area. There has been talk among the men on the council that you were perhaps the man who could do something about this matter. There are those who still remember that you won more than a little honor when you were a guardsman for Earl Jakob. I myself recall hearing him say to King Håkon that he had acted unwisely when he dealt so harshly with a capable young man. He said you were destined to be a support to your king.
Erland snapped his fingers.
You're not thinking of becoming our king, Erling Vidkunsson. Is that what all of you are plotting? He asked, laughing boisterously. To make Erling king?
Erling said impatiently, No, Erland. Can't you tell that now I was speaking in earnest?
God help me. Were you joking before? I thought you were speaking in earnest all evening. All right then, let's speak seriously. Tell me about this matter, kinsman.
Kristen was asleep with the child at her breast when Erland came into the little house. He stuck a pine branch into the embers of the hearth and then let it shine on the two of them for a long time. How beautiful she was. And he was a handsome child, their son. Kristen was always so sleepy in the evening now. As soon as she lay down and placed the boy close to her, they would both fall asleep. Erland laughed a bit and tossed the twig back into the hearth. Slowly he undressed. Northward in the spring,
with Margigrin and 3 or 4 warships. Haftor Grout, with 3 ships from Hålogaland. But Haftor had no experience. Erland would be able to command him as he liked. Yes, he realized that he would have to take charge himself, because this Haftor did not look either fearful or indecisive. Erland stretched and smiled in the dark. He was thinking of finding a crew for Margigren outside of Myrda. But there were plenty of bold and hardy boys both here in the parish and in Birgsea. He would be able to choose from the finest of men. He had been married little more than a year. Childbirth, penance, and fasting. And now the boy. Always the boy, night and day. And yet, she was still the same sweet young Kristen. Whenever he could make her forget the priest's words and the greedy suckling child for a brief time. He kissed her shoulder, but she didn't notice. Poor thing. He would let her sleep. He had so much to think about tonight. Erland turned away from her and lay staring across the room at the tiny glowing dot in the hearth. He ought to get up and cover the ashes, but he didn't feel like it. In bits and pieces, memories from his youth came back to him. A quivering ship's prow that paused a scant moment, waiting for the approaching swell, then the sea washing over it. The mighty sound of the storm and the sea. The whole vessel shuddered under the press of the waves. The top of the mast cut a wild arc through the scudding clouds. It was somewhere off the coast of Holland. Overwhelmed, Erland felt tears fill his eyes. He hadn't realized himself how much these years of idleness had tormented him. The next morning, Lavrans Björgolfsson and Sir Erling Vidkunsson were standing at the end of the courtyard, watching some of Erland's horses that were running loose outside the fence. "I think," said Lavrans, "that if Erland is to come to this meeting, then he is of such high position and birth, being the kinsman of the king and his mother, that he must step forward to join the ranks of the foremost men. But I don't know, Sir Erling, whether you feel you can trust that his judgment in these matters won't lead him to the opposing side. If Ivar Ogmundsson attempts to make a countermove, Erland is also strongly tied to the men who will follow Sir Ivar. I think it unlikely that Sir Ivar will do anything," said Erling Vidkunsson. "And Munan," he gave a slight smile, "he's wise enough to stay away. He knows that otherwise it might become clear to everyone how much or how little influence Munan Bardsson wields." They both laughed. "The truth is..." "Yes, no doubt you know better than I, Lavrans Lagmundsson. You who have your ancestors and kinsmen over there, that the Swedish nobles are reluctant to consider our knighthood equal to their own. For that reason, it's important that we exclude no man who is among the richest and most high-born. We cannot afford to let a man like Erland win permission to stay at home, jesting with his wife and tending to his estates, in whatever manner he tends to them," he said when he saw Lavrans' expression. A smile flickered across Lavran's face. "But if you think it unwise to pressure Erland in order to make him join us, then I will not do so." "I think, dear sir," said Lavrans, "that Erland would do more good here in the villages. As you said yourself, we can expect that this war levy will be met with opposition in the district south of Namdalside, where the people feel they have nothing to fear from the Russians. It's possible that Erland might be the man who could change people's minds about these matters in some way." "He has such a cursed loose tongue," Sir Erling exclaimed. Lavrans replied with a small smile. "Perhaps that's the language that will appeal more to people than the speech of more insightful men." Again, they looked at each other and laughed. "However that may be, he could do more harm if he went to the meeting and spoke too loudly. Well, if you cannot restrain him, then..." "No. I can do so only until he meets up with the kinds of birds he's used to flying around with. My son-in-law and I are too unlike each other." Erlan came over to them.
Have you benefited so much from the mass that you need no breakfast?
I haven't heard mention of breakfast. I'm as hungry as a wolf, and thirsty.
Lavran stroked a dirty white horse that he'd been examining.
Whoever the man is who tends to your horses, son-in-law, I would drive him off my estate before I sat down to eat if he was my servant.
I don't dare, because of Kristen, said Erlan. He has gotten one of her maids with child.
And do you deem it such a great achievement here in these parts, said Lavrans, raising his eyebrows, that you now find him irreplaceable?
No. But you see, said Erlan, laughing, Kristen and the priest want them to be married. And they want me to place the man in such a position that he'll be able to support the two of them. The girl refuses, and her guardian refuses, and Torda himself is reluctant. But I'm not allowed to drive him off. She's afraid that then he would flee the village. But Ulf Haldarsson is his overseer when he's home.
Erling Vidkunsson walked over towards Smeed Gudliksen. Lavran said to his son-in-law,
It seems to me that Kristin is looking a little pale these days.
I know.
Can't you talk to her, father-in-law? Erlan said eagerly. That boy is sucking the marrow out of her. I think she wants to keep him at her breast until the third fast, like some kind of pauper's wife.
Yes, she is certainly fond of her son, said Lavrans with a slight smile.
I know.
Erlan shook his head.
They can sit there for 3 hours, Kristen and Sira Eilif, talking about a rash he has here or there. And for every tooth he gets, they seem to think a great miracle has occurred. I've never heard otherwise, but that all children get teeth. And it would be more wondrous if our Nakva should have none.
Chapter 2 One evening a year later, toward the end of the Christmas holidays, Kristin Lavran's daughter and Orm Erlinson arrived quite unexpectedly to visit Master Gunnulf at his residence in Nidaros. The wind had raged and sleet had fallen all day long, since before noon, but now, late in the evening, the weather had grown worse until it was an actual snowstorm. The two visitors were completely covered in snow when they stepped into the room where the priest was sitting at the supper table with the rest of his household. Gunnulf asked fearfully whether something was wrong back at the manor, but Kristin shook her head. Erland was away on a visit in Gelmin, she said in reply to her brother-in-law's queries, but she was so weary that she hadn't felt like going with him. The priest thought about how she had come all the way into town. The horses that she and Orm had ridden were exhausted. During the last part of the journey, they had barely been able to struggle their way through the snowdrifts. Gunnulf sent his two servant women off with Kristin to find dry clothing for her. They were his foster mother and her sister. There were no other women at the priest's house. He attended to his nephew himself, and all the while, Orm talked steadily.
I think Kristin is ill. I told father, but he got angry.
She had been so unlike herself lately, said the boy. He didn't know what was wrong. He couldn't remember whether it was her idea or his for them to come here. Oh, yes. She had mentioned first that she had a great longing to go to Christchurch, and he had said that he would accompany her. So this morning, just as soon as his father had ridden off, Kristin told him she wanted to go today. Orm had agreed, even though the weather was threatening. But he didn't like the look in her eyes. Gunnulf thought to himself that he didn't like it either. When Kristin returned to the room. She looked terribly thin in Ingrid's black dress. Her face was as pale as bast, and her eyes were sunken, with dark blue circles underneath. Her gaze was strange and dark. It had been 3 months since he had last seen her, when he attended the christening at Husaby. She had looked good then as she lay in bed in her finery, and she said she felt well. The birth had been an easy one. So he had protested when Ranfrid Ivar's daughter and Erland wanted to give the child to a foster mother. Kristin cried and begged to be allowed to nurse Birgulf herself. The second son had been named after Lavran's father, Now the priest asked first about Bjørgulf. He knew that Kristin was not pleased with the wet nurse to whom they had given the child. But she said he was doing well, and that Frida was fond of him and took better care of him than anyone had expected. And what about Nikolaus? Asked her brother-in-law. Was he still so handsome? A little smile flitted across the mother's face. Nakve grew more and more handsome every day. No, he didn't talk much, but otherwise he was ahead of his years in every way, and so big. No one would believe he was only in his second winter. Even Fru Gunna said as much. Then Kristin fell silent again. Master Gunnulf glanced at the two of them, his brother's wife and his brother's son, who were sitting on either side of him. They looked weary and sorrowful, and his heart felt uneasy as he gazed at them. Orm had always seemed melancholy. The boy was now 15 years old, and he would have been the most handsome of fellows if he hadn't looked so delicate and weak. He was almost as tall as his father, but his body was much too slender and narrow-shouldered. His face resembled Erland's too, but his eyes were much darker blue, and his mouth, beneath the first downy black mustache, was even smaller and weaker, and it was always pressed tight with a sad little furrow at each corner. Even the back of Orm's thin tan neck under his curly black hair looked oddly unhappy as he sat there eating, slightly hunched forward. Kristin had never sat at table with her brother-in-law in his own house. Last year she had come to town with Erland for the springtime ting, and they had stayed at this residence, which Gunnulf had inherited from his father. But at that time, the priest was living on the estate of the Brothers of the Cross, substituting for one of the canons. Master Gunnulf was now the parish priest for Steina, but he had a chaplain to assist him while he oversaw the work of copying manuscripts for the churches of the archbishopric, while the cantor, Herr Eirik Finnsen, was ill. And during this time he lived in his own house. The main hall was unlike any of the rooms Kristin was used to. It was a timbered building, but in the middle of the end wall, facing east, Gunnulf had had masons construct a large fireplace, like those he had seen in the countries of the south. A log fire burned between cast andirons. The table stood along one wall, and opposite were benches with writing desks. In front of a painting of the Virgin Mary burned a brass lamp, and nearby stood shelves of books. This room seemed strange to her, and her brother-in-law seemed strange too, now that she saw him sitting at the table with members of his household, clerics and servant men who looked oddly priest-like. There were also several poor people, old men and a young boy with thin reddish eyelids clinging like membranes to his empty eye sockets. On the women's bench next to the old housekeepers sat a young woman with a 2-year-old child on her lap. She was hungrily gulping down the stew and stuffing her child's mouth so that his cheeks were about to burst. It was the custom for all priests at Christ Church to give supper to the poor. But Kristin had heard that fewer beggars came to Gunnulf Nikolausen than to any of the other priests, and yet, or perhaps this was the very reason, he seated them on the benches next to him in the main hall and received every wanderer like an honored guest. They were served food from his own platter and ale from the priest's own barrels. The poor would come whenever they felt in need of a supper of stew, but otherwise they preferred to go to the other priests, where they were given porridge and weak ale in the cookhouse. As soon as the scribe had finished the prayers after the meal, the poor guests wanted to leave. Gunnulf spoke gently to each of them, asking whether they would like to spend the night or whether they needed anything else, but only the blind boy remained. The priest implored in particular the young woman with the child to stay and not take the little one out into the night, but she murmured an excuse and hurried off. Then Gunnulf asked a servant to make sure that blind Arnstein was given ale and a good bed in the guest room. He put on a hooded cape. You must be tired, Orm and Kristin, and want to go to bed. Audhild will take care of you. You'll probably be asleep when I return from the church. Then Kristin asked to go with him, That's why I've come here, she said, fixing her despairing eyes on Gunnulf.
Ingrid lent her a dry cloak, and she and Orm joined the small procession departing from the parsonage. The bells were ringing as if they were right overhead in the black night sky. It wasn't far to the church. They trudged through deep, wet, new snow. The weather was calm now, with a few snowflakes still drifting down here and there, shimmering faintly in the dark. Dead tired, Kristen tried to lean against the pillar she was standing next to, but the stone was icy cold. She stood in the dark church and stared up at the candles in the choir. She couldn't see Gunnulf up there, but he was sitting among the priests, with a candle beside his book. No, she would not be able to speak to him after all. Tonight it seemed to her that there was no help to be found anywhere. Back home, Sira Iliv admonished her because she brooded so much over her everyday sins. He said this was the temptation of pride. She should simply be diligent with her prayers and good deeds, and then she wouldn't have time to dwell on such matters. The devil is no fool. He'll realize that he will lose your soul in the end, and he won't feel like tempting you as much. She listened to the antiphony and remembered the nuns' church in Oslo. There she had raised her poor little voice with others in the hymn of praise, and down in the nave stood Erland, wrapped in a cape up to his chin, and the two of them thought only of finding a chance to speak to each other in secret. And she had thought that this heathen and burning love was not so terrible a sin. They couldn't help themselves, and they were both unmarried. It was at most a transgression against the laws of men. Erland wanted to escape from a terrible life of sin, and she imagined that he would have greater strength to free himself from the old burden if she put her life and her honor and her happiness into his hands. The last time she knelt here in this church, she had fully realized that when she said such things in her heart, she had been trying to deceive God with tricks and lies. It was not because of their virtue, but because of their good fortune, that they were still commandments they had not broken, sins they had not committed. If she had been another man's wife when she met Erland, she would not have been any more sparing of his salvation or his honor than she was of the man she had so mercilessly spurned. It seemed to her now that there was nothing that wouldn't have tempted her back then, in her ardor and despair. She had felt her passion temper her will until it was sharp and hard like a knife, ready to cut through all bonds, those of kinship, Christianity, and honor. There was nothing inside her except the burning hunger to see him, to be near him, to open her lips to his hot mouth, and her arms to the deadly sweet desire which he had taught her. Oh no. The devil was probably not so convinced that he was going to lose her soul. But when she lay here before, crushed with sorrow over her sins, over the hardness of her heart, her impure life, and the blindness of her soul, then she had felt the saintly king take her in under his protective cloak. She had gripped his strong, warm hand. He had pointed out to her the light that is the source of all strength and holiness. Saint Olaf turned her eyes toward Christ on the cross. See, Kristen, God's love. Yes, she had begun to understand God's love and patience. But she had turned away from the light again and closed her heart to it. And now there was nothing in her mind but impatience and anger and fear. How wretched. Wretched she was. Even she had realized that a woman like herself would need harsh trials before she could be cured of her lack of love. And yet she was so impatient that she felt her heart would break with the sorrows that had been imposed on her. They were small sorrows, but there were many of them, and she had so little patience. She glanced at her stepson's tall, slender figure over on the men's side of the church. She couldn't help it. She loved Orm as if he were her own child. But it was impossible for her to be fond of Margaret. She had tried and tried and even commanded herself to like the child, ever since that day last winter when Ulf Haldorsson brought her home to Husaby. She thought it was dreadful.
how she could feel such ill will and anger toward a little maiden only 9 years old. And she knew full well that part of it was because the child looked so fearfully like her mother, Elena. She couldn't understand Erlan. He was simply proud that his little golden-haired daughter with the brown eyes was so pretty. The child never seemed to arouse any bad memories in the father. It was as if Erland had completely forgotten the mother of these children. But it wasn't only because Margaret resembled the other woman that Kristen lacked affection for her stepdaughter. Margaret would not tolerate anyone instructing her. She was arrogant and treated the servants badly. She was dishonest, too, and she fawned over her father. She didn't love him the way Orm did. She would snuggle up to Erland with affection and caresses only because she wanted something. And Erland showered her with gifts and gave in to the maiden's every whim. Orm wasn't fond of his sister either. That much Kristen had noticed. Kristen suffered because she felt so harsh and mean since she couldn't watch Margaret's behavior without feeling indignant and censorious. But she suffered even more from observing and listening to the constant discord between Erlan and his eldest son. She suffered most of all because she realized that Erlan, deep in his heart, felt a boundless love for the boy. And he treated Orm unjustly and with severity, because he had no idea what to do with his son or how he might secure his future. He had given his bastard children property and livestock, but it seemed unthinkable that Orm would ever be fit to be a farmer. And Erlan grew desperate when he saw how frail and weak Orm was. Then he would call his son rotten and rage at him to harden himself. He would spend hours with his son, training him in the use of heavy weapons that the boy couldn't possibly handle, urging him to drink himself sick in the evenings, and practically breaking the boy on dangerous and exhausting hunting expeditions. In spite of all this, Kristen saw the fear in Erlan's soul. She realized that he was often wild with sorrow because this fine and handsome son of his was suited for only one position in life, and there his birth stood in the way. And Kristen had come to understand how little patience Erlan possessed whenever he felt concern or compassion for someone he loved. She saw that Orm realized this too. And she saw that the young boy's soul was split. Orm felt love and pride for his father, but also contempt for Erlan's unfairness when he allowed his child to suffer because he was faced with worries which he himself, and not the boy, had caused. But Orm had grown close to his young stepmother. With her, he seemed to breathe easier and feel freer. When he was alone with her, he was able to banter and laugh in his own quiet way. But Erland was not pleased by this. He seemed to suspect that the two of them were sitting in judgment of his conduct. Oh no, it wasn't easy for Erland, and it wasn't so strange that he was sensitive when it came to those two children. And yet, she still trembled with pain whenever she thought about it. The manor had been filled with guests the week before. When Margaret came home, Erland had furnished the loft which was at the far end of the hall, above the next room and the entry hall. It was to be her bower, he said. And there she slept with the servant girl, whom Erland had ordered to keep watch over and serve the maiden. Frida also slept there along with Björgulf. But since they had so many Christmas guests, Kristen had made up beds for the young men in this loft room. The two maids and the infant were to sleep in the servant women's house. But because she thought Erlan might not like it if she sent Margaret off to sleep with the servants, she had made up a bed for her on one of the benches in the hall, where the women and maidens were sleeping. It was always difficult to get Margaret up in the morning. On that morning, Kristen had woken her many times, but she had lain back down, and she was still asleep after everyone else was up. Kristen wanted to clean the hall and put things in order. The guests must be given breakfast, and so she lost all patience. She yanked the pillows from under Margaret's head and tore off the covers. But when she saw the child lying there naked on the sheet made of hides, she took her own cloak from her shoulders and placed it over Margaret. It was a garment made from plain, undyed homespun, She only wore it when she went back and forth to the cookhouse and the storerooms, tending to the food preparation. At that moment, Erlan came into the room. He had been sleeping in a